Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Professor Reich. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, I'm delighted.
Okay, great. All right, so we're going to touch on both your two latest blog entries, one on the Senate bill and the public option, what it's come down to, and also the one you wrote 2 days ago about the disconnect between stocks and jobs. Because they're both really important. All right, joining us on the line is Professor Robert Reich. He was the 22nd Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And Professor Reich, thank you so much for joining us tonight. The first thing I want to talk to you about is the new Senate health care bill. The first vote for cloture to begin debate is going to take place tomorrow. But you wrote a wonderful blog entry about Harry Reid and what happened to the public option. Is this public option a good starting point, or is this just not good enough?
Well, Nicole, the sad reality is that the public option is in the Senate bill, but it's not really much. It's sort of a figment of a public option. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it will be made available and utilized by no more than 4 million Americans. Now, 4 million is not nobody. I mean, that's pretty good. But remember, we have a country of 300 million people. And the original idea for the first public option was that it was going to be available to everybody.
Yes, and that's what we were all hoping for. And this is severely limited as to who can get in it. And because of that, the cost savings, the great savings that we should have realized through a public option, we will not see. In fact, it will be the opposite, won't it?
That's what I'm afraid is the truth. Look, the public option, in its robust form, as many of us were advocating and as countless numbers of Americans were pushing, was going to be large enough and have the scale enough and authority adequate to negotiate low rates with drug companies and with medical and health providers, and also be a strong competitor of private for-profit insurance plans. Right now, in many places around the country, private for-profit insurance plans have almost no real competition. And the public option was critical in terms of giving them that kind of real competition. But what's emerged from the Senate is kind of a fragment, a figment of the imagination of a public option. It's an ersatz public option, a kind of a Potemkin public option. It's there, the words are there, and maybe the public who wants a public option will be reassured that the words are there. But it's so tiny as to be almost meaningless, and again, it's not going to have the power, the bargaining leverage, or the power to do anything very, very important. In fact, just the opposite, Nicole, because it's so limited, the chances are that the only people who will opt for it are people who are relatively sick or have high medical expenses, know that they will, and want to get into that public option. It's almost going to be a dumping ground for the private insurers who don't want to take people.
Exactly. So then won't it be sort of the Republicans' wet dream, where basically they can go back to it a couple of years after it's enacted and say, see, it's expensive, it's not working, and let's kill it?
Yeah, I'm afraid that's what is going to happen. Now, look, the optimistic part of my brain, and I am a cockeyed optimist, says, well, let's start with something. Let's have a public option, even though it's a little tiny thing that states can opt out from, and even though it's the costs are probably going to be greater than the savings because of this problem of so many people who are sicker or in greater need opting for the public option. Nevertheless, maybe we can start someplace and better someplace than no place. But I'm afraid the pessimist or realist in my head begins to say, wait a minute, this is a setup. This is not going to work. It's going to be expensive. It's going to allow Republicans and conservative Democrats to say, we told you so, and it's going to allow people like Joe Lieberman to negotiate for all kinds of things he may want that are nefarious, that just strip the health care bill of even more of its guts, saying, well, I'm not going to vote for anything that has a public option. How in the world could Senator Lieberman object to a public option that is available to only 4 million people?
I don't know. But you raise the good question, and it's sort of the conundrum I'm in as well. Is this something worth fighting for? Do we fight for this reform, or do we say, you know what, this bill is so flawed on both the House and the Senate, what we're looking at now, and the chances are that when they're combined, it's not going to be any better. Do we scrap it and the year that we fought over this and hope that something better would come up next year? Or do we take this as a, you know, fight for it and use it as a starting point to try to make it better?
Well, nothing is over till it's over, particularly in politics. And I say, let's keep fighting. I mean, the process continues. That is, even though the Senate is going to have a bill introduced, hopefully, we don't even know if that's going to happen. I mean, Harry Reid has got to get 60 votes. He's decided against it's called a reconciliation procedure, which would only require 51. But let's assume he gets the votes. Let's assume it goes to the House floor, the Senate floor. Then at least there's a possibility for an amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that somebody like Tom Harkin or some other progressive senator or Jay Rockefeller or maybe Al Franken, somebody would put in an amendment and call it the Ted Kennedy Amendment for Medicare for All and try to round up 51 votes. It's a long shot, but if every progressive in America, everybody who cared about health care, regardless of whether he or she called himself or herself a progressive, got on the phones and waged the campaign for this Ted Kennedy amendment for Medicare for All, maybe it would at least be a prelude, even if it didn't get 51 votes, to a second amendment, which would be the Ted Kennedy amendment for a true public option available to all. And maybe then we could possibly get 51 votes. Nicole, I'm a fighter, and I never want to give up. There's also then a reconciliation, a conference committee, rather. The Senate
Right.
and the House go to a conference committee. That conference committee is not immune to political pressure. It's not immune to pressure from the public. I don't think we should ever give up this fight.
Nor do I. And so, Professor Reich, with your background in government, obviously you still know a lot of these people. Are you talking to anybody privately and suggesting things like this, or just hoping they're going to read your writings on your blog at robertreich.com or Huffington Post or the various other places we can read your work?
Nicole, I do everything I possibly can. I talk to mm-hmm. everybody I can. I'm one very short person. I mean, there are tens of millions of us
yes.
out there.
Yes.
I wish there were hundreds of millions, but there are tens of millions of us out there. And if we do not get a good bill out of this, if we get a bill that's really lousy, I suppose we can blame the lobbyists for the insurance companies and the Republicans and the lobbyists for the big pharma. But ultimately, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. I mean, it's up to us.
Right. And a lot of the progressive organizations, from Democracy for America to Move On to the PCCC there's a bunch of them, are putting pressure on. But we need us, the regular people like me, to
yes,
get
don't
involved.
Wait for it. Don't wait for somebody else to do it for you. I mean, people say to me all the time, oh, I've tried to contact my senator. I've tried. Well, don't just try to contact your senator. Mobilize other people and contact people in states like Connecticut, where Joe Lieberman is the senator, people who you know, people who are relatives. Get them to bang on his door. Ben Nelson in Nebraska. Get anybody you know from Nebraska to call Nelson's office, to make a ruckus, to make a fuss. We can do this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can, to quote somebody who hasn't really...
Well, I don't want to be overly sanguine about
uh-huh.
it. I want to be realistic.
Yes.
It doesn't look great.
No.
But the concrete is being poured right now for something that is going to be in place for the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I mean, it's not only us and our children or our grandchildren as well. If this is a lousy bill, then... we're going to be stuck with it.
Right. Professor Robert Reich is with us. Now, I've been very critical of this. And again, I've been, you know, a lot of people I speak to are in the same boat. We could go either way. But what the optimists say to me is, look, Social Security, when it first went through, didn't cover everybody. It's a starting point. But what I'm worried about is that this is such a boondoggle, a handout for the for-profit insurance industry. And the real reform we had hoped for in terms of a public option is, I believe, it's set up to fail the way it's written now. So, again, is it better to have this than nothing?
Well, I think it's better to have this than nothing if we, that is you and I and all your listeners and every progressive in America and everybody else who cares about this stuff, will continue to fight this and work on it. I mean, nothing is ending. I mean, even a piece of legislation that emerges, as you just said about Social Security, it changes over time. Mm-hmm. If the public pushes hard enough, these things do change. They are amended. Legislation has a life. It doesn't have to be cast in concrete. But only when we get up, kind of give up and get cynical and say, oh, you know, it's just the special interests. I'm giving up on politics. I'm giving up on democracy. That kind of attitude is the ultimate defeat, because that cedes our democracy to the special moneyed interests, and also basically is a cheap way out.
Yes, and there are many of us still pushing for some semblance of the Kucinich Amendment to be put back in conference, which would allow states to enact their own single-payer plans in lieu of the exchange, which, you know, again, it's an opening, and I thought that was the bright spot in the House bill, which was taken out before they combined the three of them.
Yes, well, again, our only options right now are to push very hard for an amendment that will do, or at least begin to do, what needs to be done. You know, everybody I know who knows anything about foreign systems, I mean, everybody in Canada thinks that this is a joke. Mm-hmm. Canadians are looking at what we're doing, and they're saying, we can't believe that you Americans are having this kind of fight. We have had our own national health care system for years. It's only 10% of our entire economy in terms of our gross domestic product. Yours is 16%, you Americans. We cover everybody. We get everything done that we need done, and you can't even do something as simple as just a basic Medicare for all, or at least a public option for all. What is happening? What's wrong with you south of the border? And you know, I look at them and I talk to Canadians and others around the world, and I say, you've got to understand, everything in America takes a lot of time. Reform takes years. So I say to you, Nicole, and listeners, just keep fighting.
You got it. All right. One more moment. Professor Robert Reich, you were the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. Right now, we're seeing a very weird jobless, so-called jobless recovery. You wrote a blog entry, The Great Disconnect Between Stocks and Jobs. What's going on here? The stock market is up. On Wall Street, they're saying the recession's over, yet here on Main Street, unemployment is at an all-time high. Or at least
well,
since the Depression.
There are two things going on Wall Street and in corporate suites right now. One is that they are slashing payrolls in order to show profits. I mean, after all, up until very, very recently, their payrolls, that is, their employees, their salaries, their wages, their benefits, all of that was about 70% of their costs. So they figured that if they can get their costs down by slashing payrolls and by cutting benefits and cutting wages, they can show, at least in the very short term, they can show some profits. And that's what they've done. That's where the profits are coming from. Wall Street sees the profits, and in the short term, Wall Street says, great, your earnings are up, and therefore we have a little bit of a rally. And investors see a little bit of a rally and say, oh, great, let's get in as early as we can. Now, the other thing that's going on in Wall Street and in corporate suites is that the global economy is beginning to come back, not the U.S., but at least other countries beginning to come back. Other consumers in other places are beginning to come back. And many of our big companies are global. General Motors, for example, has sold this year 50% more cars in China than it sold last year. it's doing gangbusters in other places. And so because these global companies are showing more earnings, both from slashing payrolls and from their global operations, Wall Street is very happy. Now, if you look at Main Street here in the United States and look what's happening to workers, you see obviously unemployment is going upward and wages are trending downward. The problem for even Wall Street, is you can't go like this forever. At some point, you've got to depend on American consumers. At least most American businesses still are dependent on American consumers. And if American consumers, who are also workers, are not getting enough money or out of jobs, they are not going to go and buy all the goods and services that American companies are generating, which means that the stock market is going to sink. It's only a matter of time.
So would you say we're in the middle peak of a W-type recovery?
Well, I don't know whether it's a W or a L or a square root or what you describe it like, but the chances are getting larger for either a double dip, which would mean essentially we go down again into a recession, and Wall Street would go down as well, or a kind of a very stagnant, slow, discouraging slow emergence from all of this. I think that unemployment will stay quite high, probably officially over 10% through much of next year. Now, Nicole, one more point. The thing to keep your eye on, next year is obviously a midterm election. When we get into the gravitational pull of that midterm election, every politician in Washington is going to want to show his or her constituents that the politician is doing something about unemployment. You're going to see a huge, an uprising activity. A lot of it's going to be silly and nonsense. Republicans are going to want to do tax cuts. Democrats are going to want to do little kind of window dressing jobs programs. But at least there's an opening for real discussion about jobs.
Right. And the White House is going to be rolling out their jobs initiative. Do you think that's going to be window dressing, or is there going to be anything substantial there?
Well, the best thing the White House can do, and the best thing Congress can do right now, is to expand a stimulus somewhat, and particularly for bailing out the states. Right now, the states are slashing social services. They are cutting programs, cutting jobs, raising taxes, raising sales taxes. The states are operating a kind of anti-stimulus package, a kind of $200 billion anti-stimulus. And until that is eliminated, both on grounds of, people need the social services, especially now, and also they cannot afford tax increases. Until that anti-stimulus from the states is eliminated, we're going to have a fiscal drag that's going to make it much harder for us ever to come out of this bad economy. So the federal government really does need to come to the rescue of the states. Stop rescuing banks. Start rescuing states.
Oh, you got it. Professor Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, it is always an enlightening conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicole. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.